today on Movie World as we talk about Knives Out, The Irishman, and The Report. It's time for Movie Wallahs. Hi, this is Joe.
Hi, it's Rashmi.
And Yazdi as well.
Movie Wallahs is your weekly list of film reviews, movie news and general banter in theatres, on DVD, online streaming or on the back of an airplane. If you love the movies, this show is for you. Greetings, greetings.
Hello.
Hello.
Here we are again, united once again. Rashmi and I have been travelling. Yazdi, you've been shuffling your life around in all sorts of ways that I probably won't talk about online.
No, I've just been moving. I'm in the process of moving homes.
I was going to say Yazdi's now Yasmin, but that would be mean just to say that.
That would be mean, yes.
No, Yazdi's Yazdi.
Yeah.
So, yes, we have that kind of end of year crush is upon us. You know, that time when all these movies are like thrown out there and Rashmi's walking around the house with some sort of screen in front of her face at almost every waking moment.
It's true. I feel my duty to do it.
It's the same thing. I mean, we always grumble about this, but beginning of the year, nothing.
Nothing.
Middle of the year, the blockbusters not much. Come, and then the end of the year, all the good stuff starts just being thrown out.
Like literally in the last 3 weeks, I think we must have received 15 invites for things to watch.
It's a high-class problem.
It is. It's a first-world problem. It is. Yeah. And the problem is that most of them are good because you know they've all been saved up. So it's not like I'm watching them just out of duty. I'm actually excited to see some of them. And everyone I put on, I'm like, oh my God, this is really good. This is really good. This is really good.
Yeah, many of the ones we're going to discuss today probably will be on my end-of-the-year top 10 list.
Yeah.
So it's a good problem to have, but you know, if you have two screenings in a day, it's hard to do. And we've been having a lot of twofers.
Yeah.
But again,
good problems.
Yeah. And I feel like it bites the studios in the ass a little bit because you guys do have to put together your San Diego Film Critics think list.
Which were due on Friday, I think.
Without seeing some of these movies.
Correct.
So, I mean, I know that happened. So one movie actually screwed up 1 year, didn't they? They kind of came out too late to get on everyone's think list. And it was Selma, which was too bad. And so even when it came to, you know, a lot of critical acclaim that movie would have otherwise had, it missed the boat. So it's a game that they play. They put them out as late as possible because for whatever reason, there's a sense that the mind share of something you've seen recently will be greater than.
That's not untrue because as we were putting our think lists together, I actually use Letterboxd. Thank you to Yazdi for introducing us to Letterboxd, which is a great way to record all the movies you've watched. So I actually went back to my Letterboxd and found some things from, you know, way back when.
And just so that people listening know what you're talking about. So there's an app called Letterboxd.
Yep.
With emphasis on the D at the end, but no E. So Letterboxd, which enables you to catalog anything that you watch.
It's brilliant.
You can rate it. It does it by like the movie poster. I think there's some social aspects too where you can see what your friends like and
stuff. You can create best of lists of your own or join other people's.
But it's super
really
cool
because
you can keep track of what you've watched.
You can keep track, yeah.
And Yazdi, you told me about it.
Maybe
a couple of years ago, I think. But yeah. I've been using it too.
Yeah, so I actually went back to that because otherwise I don't know how anyone can remember performances from, you know, March of this year. But it actually helped me put together some of my thoughts for the think list. And just for our listeners who are listening, San Diego Film Critics Society does the concept where we basically send into our president a list of, it's called the think list, and you basically just brainstorm and spew everything of note on that list, and then that gets collated, and then that starts to form, you know.
And that's by voting category, right?
And that's by voting category, and then that starts to form, you know, the path to nominations and hence, you know, winners of the year, etc.
And it's also a good way because not everybody can see everything. And if on your think list, four people have recommended the same actor or the same director or the same editor, and you haven't seen that movie, that's a good way for you to say, oh crap, I'd better catch this movie somehow because it's on too many people's think list. So it really helps us kind of prioritize when you're short on time.
And you guys have a rule within SDFCS, not that this is the SDFCS podcast, San Diego Film Critics Society, but that you can't vote on something that you haven't seen.
Correct.
Which is obvious, but there's also a minimum number of movies that you have to have seen within a category. Yeah.
You have to have seen 3 out of 5.
So you can't just vote for the one movie in that category. Correct. It's anyone you saw. So it's a pretty serious process. And yeah, it's hard when everything comes out last minute to cram it all in. Still.
I mean, I think studios also have to play this game where they recognize that some of these movies are really high cachet for them. You know, they expect to get a lot of prestige out of them. So they fear that if they release those movies to too many people during this end of year rush, that the movie will get out and people will somehow pirate them or whatever. So some people just refuse to, some studios will refuse to send out the screeners at the risk that then their movie drops out of the conversation. But yeah, it's a risk they have to take. Like Clint Eastwood famously never sends any of his movies out for contention to studios. So anyway.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
And too many movies, too little time.
I know. Well, because we're kind of in a bit of a crunch at the end of the year, we've got 3 movies to talk about in this podcast. And our usual segment of I can't find anything to watch on VOD is something we'll skip probably for the next podcast or two. So you're going to have to find your own streaming movies. But seriously, there's probably so much out on the big screen this time of year that if you're spending time at home wondering what to watch, shame on you, because there's many, many great things at the movie theater. But before we did do our formal reviews this week, there were a couple of movies that I think we wanted to talk about just kind of informally, because again, these aren't things that we've had screenings for review purposes. These are movies that we've seen in some other way that we wanted to just very briefly talk about on the podcast. We thought they were notable. So on that list, I've got Jojo Rabbit and Marriage Story, I think, for this podcast. So I guess we should kind of have at it first. Does anyone want to quickly intro Jojo Rabbit?
Yeah, I'll do it. So one of my favorite directors, Taika Waititi, who we've talked a lot about on the show, has come out with his movie Jojo Rabbit, highly anticipated. And it brings, his signature style of humor and pathos. It's a World War II satire that really follows a young boy, whose world is basically turned upside down when he finds out that his mother is hiding a Jewish girl in their attic. And it's only, his only way to kind of get around the issue is to consult with his imaginary friend who happens to be Adolf Hitler. So it's an interesting premise. It's directed by a masterful director in my mind. We all saw this one at the San Diego International Film Festival.
Taika Waititi directed one of your favorite movies of all time, which is What We Do in the Shadows.
Correct, correct.
And he's Thor Ragnarok.
And Thor Ragnarok. And he's also done like Hunt for the Wilder People as well. So,
We saw this at San Diego International Film Festival. So we got a chance to kind of view it really before it's formal release. I know the movie carried with it a lot of buzz. The premise is obviously controversial, but I'll kick in.
And just before you start, Joe, just quickly, it's got Thomasin McKenzie and Taika Waititi, Rebel Wilson, Stephen Merchant, Scarlett Johansson is in here, and I know I'm forgetting someone.
No, the little boy.
Yes, who is Griffin, Roman Dan. Griffin.
Yeah, right. Roman Griffin, yeah.
Yeah.
So, again, not a formal review, but just give you my 2 cents on the movie. This was really, really clever. The movie comes with a certain amount of controversy. The material itself is satirical in the sense of, it deals with topics, and it has a sense of humor through it that could be deemed offensive to some by many. I think it walks that line of wanting to depict things as ridiculous as they are, but also with a seriousness that makes us kind of look and reference what's going on in the world today, perhaps. So I thought this was a brilliant movie. It was very funny, heart-moving. It's tonally a little bit inconsistent. I can see that, reviews have been somewhat mixed, but I think most of that comes from the fact that the movie, either you buy into its humor or you don't. If you do and it clicks, it falls into place, you'll have one of the favorite movies of the year. If it doesn't, it may be a little bit more abrasive. But I really like this.
Yazdi.
Yeah, I mean, as Joe said, it's very tricky to do a movie where you're trying to satirize the Holocaust and, you know, the Second World War and Adolf Hitler in particular. And, you know, I think like Mel Brooks, who realized very early on that the best way to deal with such horror is through satire and by making fun of them. And I think this movie does the same thing. And I think it's pretty remarkable that Taika Waititi wrote, directed, and acted in this movie. I think the movie kind of initially starts off with its cards very close to its chest. And you're just seeing this boy who is absolutely an enthral of Adolf Hitler. And he's an enthral of the Third Reich, and he wants to be a part of it. And
he's a victim of propaganda.
Well, he's brainwashed. Yeah.
He's been brainwashed, and as many people were. And, you know, it's funny. It's kind of goofy. You know, Sam Rockwell plays kind of a funny character and so forth. And then I think the movie catches you by surprise as it moves on. It kind of retains some of the humor, but then suddenly starts moving into, you know, pretty severe, serious material. And I think therefore there is necessarily a shift in tone that needs to happen. I think the acting is incredible across the board. I think Scarlett Johansson with her German accent, I don't know how good it was, but she is very, very good here. She's having a great year. The little boy who plays, we see the entire movie pretty much through his eyes. He's incredible. Thomasin McKenzie, who we last saw in Leave No Trace. She's brilliant in a very difficult role. But I just want to say that it takes a lot of ambition to make a movie like this and not just make another sequel or make another movie, which, you know, it's a straight out comedy or it's a straight out, you know, college romance or whatever. I mean, there's somebody trying to do something very different. And
absolutely,
I think we need to recognize that and give the person credit. I think people should absolutely go out and see it. There's almost no nudity. There's no bad language here. And at the end, it's nothing less than the awakening of consciousness in a young person's life who, without almost no adult guidance, has to on his own learn the big burden you carry when you embrace hate. And this is big stuff. And the movie kind of, it maybe overdoes it a little bit towards the end. I'm not a big fan of the very, very end, but everything is forgiven. It's a brilliant movie.
Love, 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 love. This is on my top 10 list. I've put it on my think lists for probably every category. I think this is, I won't repeat what you guys have said. In addition, I think Thomasin McKenzie is not a one-trick pony. We were all enthralled with her in Leave No Trace last year. She is a truly magnificent actress, and I think that's one to watch out for. Scarlett Johansson blew me away in this movie. I mean, her performance was just sublime. It's a very difficult role that she's playing. It's almost Mary Poppins-esque in some way, how brightly she's cast, and then the role that she ends up doing. Taika Waititi is just genius for me. I mean, his humor, our cogs click. I get him 100%. I want to be his friend. If you're listening, Taika, Mr. Waititi, I think it's difficult to do this. Quentin Tarantino did a really good job in Inglourious Bastards, kind of covering not similar material, but, you know, in the same vein, in the same shade. This is difficult to do. My only criticism of the movie is I wish that he had almost been more satirical. I feel like he almost shied away and clicked it down one notch, and I wanted him to click up one notch. I could have done with it being even more in your face, and I think it's a really important movie because if humor allows us to be woke, Yazdi, to your point, then that's the way we need to do it, and it's so important in 2019 to tell the story of World War II. I can't believe I'm saying this, that, you know, in 2019, we need to be educated about this. We need to be awake. And this really does a good effort of doing that. So love this movie.
Yeah, and the particularly the price you have to carry with hate, the price you have to pay with unfairly demonizing another group,
Yeah.
Because there are great exchanges between the two kids in the movie, Thomas and Mackenzie and Dunn. Roman Griffin. Where essentially he's reading a book which shows, you know, very, very, or not talking about characters, about how Jewish people look and how they might seem. And it's flat out lie. But that's what is being spun. And I think in current times, you know, all that kind of stuff, the burdens of hatred and of perpetuating and lies and all of that, I think it's all very relevant.
So Jojo Rabbit, check that one out if you
please
can.
Do.
I believe it's still in theaters.
It's doing very well, yeah.
You know, it's one that I believe we'll all, and it's one we felt, even though we didn't see it formally for Movie Wallahs, we felt compelled to kind of talk about it here.
And it's so funny. I mean, we haven't even talked about how funny it is. Okay.
I think the only misstep is Rebel Wilson. I didn't care for her. She was trying to be Rebel Wilson in a movie that was all kinds of other things, which was a square peg in a round hole, but yeah.
I guess that's why you employ her.
Yeah. Right, yeah. I mean, yeah, she was maybe not the best choice, but
yeah.
Next movie is Marriage Story, which comes from writer-director Noah Baumbach. And so, again, this isn't a formal review, but just very briefly. Noah Baumbach, I think we know from recent years for some of our favorite movies here on the podcast. I know, Yazdi, you're a huge fan of movies like Frances Ha, Mistress America. There was a movie called While We're Young that I liked a lot. Rashmi, he wrote Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Yeah.
For Wes Anderson, which I know was a favorite of yours. So, again, just very briefly, movie star Scarlett Johansson, Adam Driver, Laura Dern, Alan Alda, Ray Liotta, among many others, terrific cast. Very briefly, it's about a stage writer and his actor wife who are struggling through a grueling coast-to-coast divorce that pushes them to their personal and creative extremes. So I didn't get to see this one. I was out of town when this one screened, but I think the two of you did. What are your thoughts?
So,
and this comes out on Netflix, right? This is going to be a Netflix release, I believe.
I think it's going to be the same way as The Irishman, that they're going to release it in theaters for a couple, maybe 4 weeks in certain select theaters, and then it becomes available for streaming on Netflix.
So another win for Scarlett Johansson. I mean, she is doing great work. Marriage Story blew me away. It's a really interesting way to cover a story that's been told a million times before about, you know, a couple whose marriage is disintegrating, and do you tell it from the beginning or do you tell it from the middle or do you tell it from the end? And this kind of covers all of that. Perfect performances from Adam Driver and Ray Liotta. So good to see him again. And Laura Dern is almost playing the same character she plays in Big Little Lies, but nonetheless very, very good. It's a view into a couple's life. And I would say my only criticism of this is somehow I feel like this is told from the male perspective and the female comes off, even though the male, they both do things wrong, I felt like we see the male in a more sympathetic light than the female. And again, that just may be my own bias.
So probably very true to life then.
Yeah, the male is always, you know, we always have a more sympathetic, you know, feeling towards a male in the divorce
women are no
than the
good.
Female.
Yeah. Men are trustworthy. Yeah, it's true
yeah,
to life.
Usual like, BS. Okay. Yeah, yeah. But no, fantastic. Absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, there have been a lot of prestige movies which have come out or are in the process of coming out. This might be my favorite amongst all of those.
Wow.
I really like this movie. It got under my skin and
Did you cry?
I did. I did.
Yeah. I tried not to look.
And I cried, funnily enough, not when I should cry. I cried at how the movie resolved. But I think how many movies have been made about, you know, the history of cinema is the history of, you know, men and women interacting with each other. And so many movies made about divorce in particular, and it's interesting that he has chosen to call this movie The Marriage Story and not Divorce Story, because it is a divorce story. But, and you know, there was a lot of hoopla before this movie opened. They were calling it this generation's Kramer versus Kramer, etc. And it is all of that. The script is so, so specific, and it's so perfect that maybe I'm taking away credit from Noah Baumbach as a screenwriter, but it cannot be fiction. So it's so specific, and it's so painful, and it's so authentic that, you know, I suspect Noah Baumbach actually went through this, and he did get a divorce from Jennifer Jason Leigh about 7-8 years ago. And I suspect he's written this whole, you know, story based on his experience with going through it. So I think there is some necessary bias in terms of he's the one who's writing this story. But even then, I think the movie at no point feels like it's taking sides. Maybe the female character comes off a little unreasonable at times, but at the same time, the male character is no saint. I mean, he has an affair, so I don't think he's not trying to make himself look good through this whole thing necessarily. It is how it is, and when there's a child involved, and it's a story of how two people decide to separate for whatever reason. And how the system completely puts you through the ringer. And I was not aware about half of the things. I did not know that if you're seeking divorce from another person, that if one of them goes and meets with the top 6 divorce lawyers, then the other spouse cannot go to them because they're already biased. So what people will do, what the good divorce lawyers will tell you, is go meet, consult with these other 5 good divorce lawyers just so that your husband or your wife cannot then use them. So there is so much, you know, the lawyers are playing so much of it, and people are, you know, there's so much money, and then there is, you know.
It's as much about the bureaucracy of divorce, it is about the divorce that they end up going through. But what's novel about this movie is that it starts with almost a love letter to each. And very nice. I mean, we shouldn't give too much away.
Yeah, we shouldn't give. And, you know, I'm willing to bet, I'm putting my dollar down, Adam Driver is getting nominated for Best Actor. Probably Scarlett Johansson is getting nominated for Best Actress. Definitely Laura Dern is getting nominated for Best Supporting Actress.
Wow.
And Alan Alda, I think, may pull one. He's very beloved as well. But be that aside, I think the movie also makes the point that these are two, they have their differences, but these are two mostly nice, good people. And they're trying to just navigate this process and get through the other side, and how the system can force you to make the other person the enemy. And it's very empathetic. It's very real.
It's almost too real.
It makes you realize how completely traumatizing that experience can be for everyone involved. So kudos to them. I just love this movie. It's like going through the ringer and coming out at the other end.
Wow.
It's quite something.
High praise indeed. Yes. So
please, people, watch The Marriage Story.
Two movies there. Jojo Rabbit, The Marriage Story. Again, it's frustrating in so many ways that these movies come crushed at the end of the year with so many other good movies. But we didn't give them the formal review, but do please check them out. And I do believe that Marriage Story will be on Netflix by December 6th. So that's when you can see it at home in not too much time.
Yeah.
Okay. So we do have 3 formal reviews to cover in this podcast. So we have The Irishman, we have Knives Out, and The Report. Should we start with maybe Knives Out?
Sure. And I'm covering that one. So Knives Out is, it's a great ensemble cast. And this is all I'll give away. A detective investigates the death of a patriarch of an eccentric combative family. This is directed and written by Rian Johnson. Yes, that Rian Johnson of Star Wars fame and other amazing movies. And this has a huge cast. This has Daniel Craig, Chris Evans. It has Jamie Lee Curtis, Don Johnson, Toni Collette, Michael Shannon, Lakeith Stanfield. So many people are in this movie.
Yazdi.
Okay.
So Rian Johnson made Looper. He made a lot of movies. He was called to direct the second episode of the new trilogy of Star Wars, The Last Jedi. And I think in many circles, he's been penalized and beaten to death about, you know, the path, the rather dark path that The Last Jedi took. And I think personally that this was Rian Johnson's way of saying, I can't deal with all these crazy fans who have kind of turned on me. Let me just go on the side and make a fun movie. And boy, what a fun movie he's made. This is like, you know, like a wet dream of the, of a cast. I mean, think, I mean, I can, you cannot top this cast. Daniel Craig and Chris Evans and Tony Collette and Michael Shannon and, you know, 100 other people. It harkens back in the very first 5 minutes. It harkens back to a good old fashioned Agatha Christie kind of murder mystery. And it doesn't have any aspirations beyond that. It wants to entertain you. It's throwing red herrings at you constantly. It's about the patriarch of a family who gets murdered and everybody's a suspect. And Daniel Craig is this, detective with a questionable accent. I couldn't quite place. Was that a southern? A southern accent?
Yes.
Okay. But this movie is too clever. It's too clever for its own good, but it's so much fun. I had like a smile on my face the entire time I was watching it. It's visually great. It has so many cards up its sleeve. It's entirely a miracle that a movie this good can come out of the studio system. Again, what can I say? This is the best time of the year. Another absolute winner of a movie. I love this film.
What Yazdi said. So to me, this played like a modern day Clue. And like the film Ready or Not that we reviewed a few podcasts ago, I had so much fun like Yazdi at the movie. But literally, as soon as I left the theater, it completely evaporated from my head. And in fact, every time I think about it, I have to keep reminding myself what it was about and who was in it. It's the weirdest sensation. It is a great ensemble, and I love how 90% of the cast are actually playing against type.
Mm-hmm.
So great performances by Tony Collette and Daniel Craig. And even Chris Evans, to see him not in a Marvel universe was really good.
And he's playing the black sheep, which he seldom does. He's Mr. Goody Goody.
Yeah. And I think, again, look, the family dynamic is so great and so fun and, you know, reminds us of the good and bad of family. Really good movie. Really, really good movie.
And it's so tongue-in-cheek. There are references to Agatha Christie. Somebody's watching Murder, She Wrote on the television. It's like little nudges.
Hilarious. It's so cute.
It's just a well-oiled machine.
Yeah.
And I would not mind if every year come Christmas time, there would be a new movie with
this cast.
With this cast, or even just with Daniel Craig as the detective going
yes.
around, you know, solving other mysteries.
That would be great. I mean, it really it's very nostalgic.
Yes.
It's a modern day movie, which just evokes this nostalgia. Really fun. Like, and then that same vein of kind of Ready or Not, I felt like it really played very, very close to that for me.
It is quite a change for Rian Johnson because, you know, as Yasti mentioned, Star Wars was his last big thing. But before that, he did a movie called Looper.
Mm-hmm.
And I think before that, his debut was a movie called Brick, was this kind of modern day film noir, with Joseph Gordon-Levitt, if I remember rightly, that received great acclaim. I just saw it and wondered what all the fuss was about. But, this one, again, shows that he's no one-trick pony. He's no flash-in-the-pan director. And to come from Star Wars to something like this shows such a breadth of...
And to do it well.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? There's one thing to do it well...
And he wrote and directed this one. So, again, sounds like, yes, you're absolutely right. This was...
one for him.
Yeah, this was one for him. And, you know, when you have so many big name actors, by definition, some of them are going to get short shrift, right? Not everybody is going to have a meaty role. And some of them are just red herrings in terms of, you know, who the real murderer is. But he gives enough for them to do. And sometimes you're just happy to see, you know,
Don Johnson
on the screen, or Michael Shannon.
And he's good.
Michael Shannon not completely chewing the scenery off the walls, you know?
Yeah.
He's just playing his little role. And,
but the way the dynamic of the family works too is just, it's so much richer than what there's so much more there than we're not seeing about this family that just comes across. Yeah. All right, should we sum this one up?
Yeah.
Joe, do you want to say anything about the bits that you did see?
No, I mean, I remember thinking the movie was, you know, far too clever for my jet lag brain to be dealing with. And so I think I enjoy, I mean, it's tonally, you know, really quite funny. I mean, it's not an out and out comedy, but I recall it being very funny in places in terms of, you know, the characters and their idiosyncrasies, their quirks, their behaviors. And it felt, I think, to me again, jet lagged brain notwithstanding, just one too many twists. So, you know, by the time I was at the end with the twist within the twist within the twist within the, you know, it was too complex for me. So definitely one to be awake for while watching. And, yeah. And again, this was really, you know, I hesitate to even say anything here simply because I was just you know, in a completely different time
zone.
Okay,
so no score from Joe.
So no score. But okay, it felt very accomplished and very polished.
Listen, this is 97% on the Tomato Meter.
I can see that.
And
yeah,
I cannot not recommend this to anyone, be it a 5-year-old, you know, a 90-year-old. I would recommend this to anyone. I want to give it a 9 out of 10, but I'm going to give Marriage Story would be a 9 out of 10, but we're not.
We can have 2 9s.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's just so much fun. And I know that it doesn't. Some of those characters don't have enough to
Let me predict what Yazdi's going to say. I'm going to give this one 8.5, which I'm going to back down to an 8. Is that right, Yazdi? Yazdi!
Okay, I'll give it a 9.
Yay!
Fine.
The holidays come.
Yes, yes, yes.
9 from Yazdi. I'm going to give it an 8.
Well, thanks a lot.
I'm going to give it an 8 because, look, I can't remember who did it, but I remember I had a great time watching them do it.
Who did it.
No, I can't. I really can't. It's a weird thing that's happened in my brain. But I remember I enjoyed watching them do it. Solid 8 out of 10. I think I want to go back and watch this one. And again, like Yazdi said, I think this is one of those movies over the holiday period. Thanksgiving is upon us. The whole family can go out and watch this together. There's nothing.
Yeah.
Rude or crazy or explicit or foul. This is a great holiday movie.
And it opens on Thanksgiving Day.
Yay. Yeah.
Yes.
Terrific. Put your knives out at home and go watch Knives Out.
Oh, there you go.
Two more movies to cover. We have The Irishman and The Report. Do you want to tackle them in that order or switch
Why don't
around?
I cover The Report quickly? Because I think I'm the only one that saw that.
All right.
Sure. So let me introduce the report. So first-time director Scott Z. Burns, but he's famous for writing a lot of books. Scott Z. Burns. Scott Z. Burns.
I thought you were giving him like his own cutesy name.
I'm glad you called that out, Rashmi. I thought you were saying Scott Z.
No, it's Scott period Z period Burns.
I get it now.
Okay.
Okay.
So.
Scott C.
writer and director Scott Z. Burns actually dramatizes what happened when the idealistic Senate staffer Daniel J. Jones, who was tasked by his boss, Dianne Feinstein, to lead an investigation into the CIA's post 9/11 detention and interrogation program and how this person uncovers shocking secrets. So if you guys remember, there was a lot of pressure after 9/11 to use whatever methods available at extract information from those members of Al-Qaeda that had been collected by the CIA. And there was a lot of press at that time in terms of the ethics of it, the legality of it, the morality of it. How much do you push people in order to extract truth from them? And I believe this is based on that. And Adam Driver, who like Scarlett Johansson, is having a terrific year.
Again,
leads the cast is Daniel Jones. Corey Stoll, who we all like, is in the movie. John Hamm, who we also like, is in the movie. Annette Bening plays Senator Dianne Feinstein. Woohoo! And Maura Tierney, who we don't see a lot of, is in this movie, as well as is Michael C. Hall. This movie is, I believe, currently streaming on Amazon Prime. So if you have Amazon Prime, you can watch it right now.
Oh, it's a sneaky Netflix pick, or I can't find anything to watch on VOD.
Or is it?
Correct.
Or is it, Rashmi? So did you like it? Because you're the only one of us that has seen it.
It is a good watchy. Like Scotsy.
Watchy Scotsy like movie. Scotsy
movie. Okay, movie. No, it is a good movie to watch on streaming. So this felt a lot like the love child of Zero Dark Thirty and Spotlight. And initially when it started, I was like thinking, oh, here we go, another political drama with, you know, over-the-top Adam Driver. But it really is... it's an important story that needs to be watched by everyone, especially in the current political climate. It does this very clever thing of having some quite good animation, because basically a lot of this movie is about Daniel Jones.
Daniel J. Jones. Yeah.
Being locked up in a federal building, looking at, you know, trailing through reams and reams of electronic documents. But it does a good job of kind of keeping things going and moving things along at a brisk pace. So it uses these smart graphics and animation, almost like you would see in a documentary, which really keeps your attention, I think, which is good. And it's, look, a good, solid performance by all of the people you mentioned. I don't know if Annette Bening did justice to the Diane Feldstein character, but I think she attempted a good, you know, Feldstein. It's hard because most of the people that are being portrayed in this movie are actually still alive. And while you were doing the intro, I was actually looking on my phone because Daniel Jones actually appeared on a podcast on one of my favorite podcasts ever, which is with a guy called Preet Bharara called...
It's called
Stay Tuned.
Stay Tuned, yeah.
Stay Tuned. Which is a great podcast, by the way. Daniel Jones was actually a guest the day after I watched the movie. So that was very interesting to hear the real Daniel Jones cover the real story. So from his perspective, I think they did a good job on the movie. It's disturbing in the sense of the foreboding it creates about the way that government works and kind of how it should work because, you know, it is so interesting and relevant to what's happening now. And it does kind of cover this shifting, you know, emotion that we as Americans had around what happened on 9/11 and how much we thought was acceptable because of how bad that was and kind of then what's the right thing to do. So it doesn't really apportion blame as such. It doesn't try and portray someone as a bad guy or a good guy. It's not taking a stance in terms of being an overly Democratic or Republican movie. It's kind of just trying to tell the situation as it happened and the importance, I think, of what these Congress people do to create oversight. So, look, it's not so jingoistic and it doesn't necessarily take a side, but it tries to expose the truth. And for that, I give it a solid 7 out of 10. Definitely worth a watch.
Okay.
Great. Another one straight to streaming. So, yep. You know, the we've talked about this before, but just so many dollars are going into these, you know, what would be presumably ordinarily theater releases that we're getting to enjoy in our homes. Terrific stuff.
Yeah, it's great that I think everyone will get to watch it. I just worry that it gets lost in the shuffle of everything that's there. That's the only thing.
And there is no bigger example of that than perhaps the next movie, The Irishman, which is directed by Martin Scorsese, but also going straight to Netflix. So, Yasti, I think you want to give us a quick background on The Irishman?
Yeah, so Martin Scorsese, who literally needs no introduction, this is his latest movie, The Irishman. And this was a movie which was in the making for a little while, and it got a lot of people excited because it reunites him with Robert De Niro, and it also includes Joe Pesci, with whom he's worked before so many times, and a new iconic actor that actually Scorsese has never worked with before, which is Al Pacino. So the
I didn't know that.
We're calling him
Scotsy.
I didn't know the two of them had never worked together. Yeah, that's news together. To me. Wow. Okay.
So the tag at the in the ads, you know, list Joe Pesci as the quiet one, Robert De Niro as the middleman, and then
Al Pacino
as the union boss. I believe he plays the ultimate union boss, Jimmy Hoffa here. This particular movie has writing credits to Charles Brandt. It's based on his book, and Steven Zalian did the screenplay adaptation for the movie. Like I said, it is directed by Martin Scorsese. Full warning, the movie is 3 hours and 29 minutes long. But in terms of additional actors, this is amazing. It has Jesse Plemons in it, Anna Paquin is here, Bobby Cannavale, who we see a lot of late, he's here, Harvey Keitel is here, Ray Romano is here, Steve Van Zandt, a lot of names that we have heard of before. What does, at this point, Martin Scorsese have to say about The Mob that he hasn't already? So, you guys saw it, and so, speak away.
We did, indeed, yeah. I'll start, I guess. It's almost ironic to me that the biggest piece of cinema this year will be seen by most people on a small screen. And, you know, as much as I'm a fan of Netflix, I think its convenience factor means that many people view movies on their mobile phones, on iPads, portable screens, and the like. This is a big screen movie, not necessarily because of the fact that it's, hugely visual in any way, but this is an epic movie, right? This follows an epic timescale. This has an epic cast. It has an epic director at the helm. It's big and it's huge, and one should see it on a big and huge screen in a focused environment. So I've just got to get that off my chest first. I love this movie. It was remarkable to me that its running time passed by in what seemed like half an hour. I mean, we know that this movie, you know, has been kind of touted as being, you know, this kind of marathon 3.5 hour length, but the time passed by so quickly. It was so thoroughly engaging. It does a lot of clever time sequence things, and not in the Tarantino sense, but, you know, there are a couple of different narratives that the movie kind of covers, you know. So there's, you know, old time, the new time. It cuts cleverly back and forth. The movie actually opens with, you know, a very aged De Niro character almost telling his life story. So, but the epic grandness of its scale, Steve Zalian, who wrote it, you know, also wrote Schindler's List. Mm-hmm. And the writing craft on display here is as good as I've ever seen anything this year. The acting craft on display here is as good as anything I've seen this year. The directing craft on display. Yeah, you get what I'm saying. This is a stunner of a movie. It did feel a little lazy in the sense of
editing
and indulgent in the sense of, this is very familiar turf for Scorsese, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. This is none of what we see here is anything that we haven't seen before from him. It's just another masterpiece from a master director. And in that way, it feels a little lazy, but, you know, I can't call Scorsese lazy because, you know, he has done so many other, you know, he's done Hugo, which was, you know, very different to the kind of movie. His last movie was,
he's done Shutter Island. He's done Age of Innocence, Silence was the other one.
Silence, that's right. Yeah. That very different movie. So I can't call him lazy by re-entering this world with which he is so familiar. But it has very similar feeling to Goodfellas and The Casinos and the other kind of gangster mob movies. But there's a reason he's the master at those. I loved it. I mean, it's close to perfection for me.
I agree with Joe. Look, I think prepare, and it's really hard not to build this up.
Yeah, I know.
And I don't want to do that, but I can't help it, because prepare yourself for the best movie you're going to see this year. Look, we've seen some incredible movies, and we've been talking about a lot of them in this podcast, but there's something sublime about this. To me, it feels like, again, I'm going to say it's the love child of Goodfellas meets JFK in some ways. You're right, Joe. It's nothing that we haven't seen before, but it feels like all of those things that he did previously were the mise en place for this incredible 20-course meal that we had at a 3-star Michelin restaurant. It's sublime in the way that it jumps around in that time scale so much, but not once did I not know where we were at in the story. And we go down rabbit holes and we come back. And the rabbit holes we go down go into other rabbit holes at times. And it's almost like Inception, where you're trying to count the number of dreams within the dream within the dream. But again, I never didn't know where I was, either in the overall timeline or the story as a whole. So it really holds together. And to me, it really feels like the life of a mobster. We are really seeing the evolution of how a mobster becomes a mobster and the things that they go through, and then really what happens to them. And then in the background, there's this whole Jimmy Hoffa story. And again, I'm fascinated by that period of history. We've talked about my strange obsession with that period.
Obsession.
Yeah, unhealthy obsession with the Kennedys and that period of American history. So for me, I was like a pig in poop. And the 3 hours and 29 minutes just zips by. I think the first time I looked at my watch, we were literally 10 minutes off the 2-hour mark. So it just keeps your attention. It was more just, I was fascinated to see where we were. Music, directing, the slowdowns, the walk, the long walks that we take with characters, the long shots, the cinematography, incredible editing. Everyone is on their A game here. And to see people acting together, like De Niro and Pesci acting together, and De Niro and Al Pacino acting together, and the three of them acting together, and then Bobby Cannavale, and again, you know, like Ray Romano. Ray Romano's playing completely, again, not cast. Really good performances. I mean, this was like the best Sopranos episodes with all of those Scorsese movies all mixed in together. It was just amazing.
Yeah, I'm very happy. I haven't seen the movie. I missed the screening, and I'm dying to see it. And I've already vented about how messed up the studio system is, that they couldn't finance this movie from ostensibly the most famous, greatest living American director. But the one thing I'm happy about is that there was a lot of noise before the movie came out about how the movie uses extensively de-aging technology. And, you know, Gemini Man recently kind of fell, I guess, succumbed to that a little bit. But I'm so happy to hear that I don't hear anybody mention anything about it, which means that it's not distracting at all, that it must have worked reasonably well. So good on him, that it's one more tool that the good filmmakers have in their hands now.
I actually hadn't heard any of the fussing around the use of CG to de-age these characters, because frankly, I didn't notice it, and I didn't really give it any thought. In fact, it wasn't until I came out of the movie and, you know, I did hear a discussion about it that I thought, oh yeah, I guess he was a little too young then. You know, he was younger than, you know, we saw De Niro in audience earlier this year at Tribeca Film Festival, and, you know, he's an older guy now, right? He's been around the block. He's in an advanced age, his 70s, I guess. And he's playing a much younger version of himself I didn't notice it, just because he's such a familiar screen presence that it almost, now that I think about it, you know, it almost adds an extra point of kudos to the movie that, you know, this almost felt like it was filmed back in the day when we had a younger De Niro. I didn't lose any of the, I didn't have any of the uncanny valley moments that I had in Gemini Man. Yeah, it totally pulled it off for me, but maybe that's because the rest of the movie was so engaging that I wasn't distracted by looking for those flaws. I was too busy being in the moment of the movie rather than kind of, you know, pulled out and having that moment where, oh, here I am sitting in a movie theater looking at a screen. Oh, look, there's something there that doesn't look quite right. I didn't, you know, I was too invested.
I noticed it once, very, very briefly, where Joe Pesci's head looked too big for his body at one stage, but it was literally one scene,
he's only
one
a little
moment.
Guy, you know
and
that.
He's a little guy, so his head looked really big, but it was in a car window, and so I noticed it. It just looked strange. It looked like one of those, you know, those elf things that you get at Christmas where people put
hilarious.
Your heads on a dancing elf. That was the only point in time that I noticed it, and I noticed it one point in the eyes for Robert De Niro, where his eyes look really, really blue, but that's a minor detail. The beauty of this movie, and I think the elevation for a Scorsese movie is, you know, you were talking about in a previous podcast, Vince Gilligan being the master of show, don't tell. And I feel like this is the movie where Martin Scorsese mastered that technique. There's a lot in what isn't said. It's so dialogue heavy, right? It's 3 hours and 29 minutes. And the dialogue is so witty and funny and sinister at times. There's a lot of quiet moments, though, where things are being said, but it's the absence of what's being said that makes it sinister. Mm. That's amazing. That there is this amazing scene where
yeah.
Joe Pesci is basically ordering a murder.
Well,
and I won't say much more, but it's just beautiful how it plays.
No, I mean, I think the show not tell thing is a little different in that, you know, Gilligan's a very visual director, so he can, you know, string us along visually to tell a story without any dialogue at all. This was just beautiful writing where the interaction between the cat, beautiful writing coupled with beautiful acting plus very, very controlled and thoughtful direction, because there are some difficult moments between characters in this movie, as one would expect of, you know, a world where violence and murders occur, where just it's not even that. I mean, that scene's a great version of it, but, you know, the De Niro character and his family, you know, who know that he is involved in this thing, but they never discuss it. You know, the wives of the mobsters, the world around them that understands that these are not good people.
Mm.
So yeah, it's just masterfully written.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's a standout moment that I'm sure will be the one that gets played during all of the award nominations, of which there will inevitably be,
I think this will
hundreds
get,
of awards.
Yeah, I was going to say it probably gets every category.
But it's, you know, two people are saying words that aren't directly related to what they're talking about, but we all know, and it's just, it's a very tense and beautiful moment.
And it's based on a true story.
Yeah, now that's some. I wasn't actually aware of the Frank Sheeran character. I mean, I knew the Jimmy Hoffa and you know, many of the other. The movie does this very funny thing, which just about everyone in it has come to an untimely end. So, you know,
I've heard about this. Yeah,
you kind of see early on in the movie, the action will just freeze frame, and it will say, you know,
shot Mr. three Smith times shot in 1989.
Yeah, yeah.
That's
the first time it happens. I was like, okay, that's an interesting detail about this character that seemingly has no part in this movie, but they're just depicting the world in which these characters exist. I mean, you know, that brought it all the more home that this is a real set of events, and, you know, embellish it as you will with screenwriting and Hollywood. These people met horrible, you know, fates that the movie doesn't get
into. And their names are so funny.
Boom, you know, there they are. Mm. So.
Big Eye Tony.
So, yeah, I mean, I don't really have a bad thing to say, and I thought I would be sitting here grumbling about how long it was.
Sounds like it's summing
up. I'm going to. And I think I think the only thing is it feels really indulgent. Like, Scorsese has been allowed to. And I think maybe that's one of the advantages of a Netflix distribution here, is that, you know, movie theaters want to have like two and a half hour turnaround so that they can sell a ticket and get people in and out for another screening. Whereas 3.5 hours is off-putting to many people. I mean, you know, if you weren't raised in the world of Bollywood, I think, you know, the where those kind of epic movies are standard fare. For Hollywood types, you know, anything over 2.5 hours starts to push it a little. So I felt that there was never a point in this movie where I thought, you know what, they need to cut this scene because it doesn't add. But I did feel that this movie could have almost been two movies and been just as epic. And, you know, this is like Godfather 1 and 2 put together in many ways. So, yeah, it's a 9 out of 10 for me easily. I know, Rashmi's sneering. I
made Yazdi give 9 to the other one. really? You just said perfection.
Well,
don't push him.
You know,
10 out of 10 you want.
Yeah, no, Rashmi's trying to bump everyone's scores up today. It probably will be in the fullness of time. The only thing, again, the reason I guess I'm not giving it a 10 is I didn't have that same giddy glee that I had when I came out of something like Casino or Goodfellas, where I felt like I had seen something new for the first time. This is something that I feel has a very familiar tone to it. It's just another terrific, you know, dose of that, but it doesn't feel like it's something new. So, you know, that's the only reason I guess it's not giving me that giddy glee, but it's a superb movie. Probably the best movie of the year for me so far. And I really struggle to get those words out of my mouth because I hate saying those kind of hyperbolic things, especially when, you know, it builds expectation for those that haven't seen it. But I mean, really, it's deserving.
I'm giving it the giddy girly 10. Oh. this is sublime. My only criticism, if I had one, was that the Anna Paquin role was, or the daughter role was a bit strange. And I felt like more was going to come of it and it didn't. And so I feel like that's something that's just hanging out there of all of the little loops and rabbit holes that we went down. That to me was the most underwritten piece. Even though it plays a major part in the movie, but we can talk about that afterwards if you thought otherwise. I don't think movies come better than this. I mean, they just don't. And sometimes they don't have to be new. Sometimes you just want more of something that's really, really good. And this is a director and actors at the top of their game. And to see them just acting together and do what they do amazingly well was just a treat.
It is what it is.
10 out of 10.
All right, let's wrap up the podcast. Thank you for hanging with us. It's almost an hour in. So, you know, for those of you that have made it to the end of this podcast,
I wonder if you could edit this down to 20 minutes.
Yeah, not going to happen. This is the Scorsese edition. Until our next podcast, it's Too Many Movies, Too Little Time. A goodbye from me.
And me.
And me as well.